Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I am airing the second part of my interview with David Politis on his new book, Missing 411 Hunters. I did do an extra segment with him for patrons. It's only a couple minutes long. I'll be putting it up hopefully this week. So if you're a patron, you'll get that. I'm going to have a bunch of multi-part interviews coming up. And like this one, if you're a patron, you'll get both parts. As well, we got this big raffle coming up. And I think next week, hopefully, I'll be able to tell you a little more about that as I work out the details and get some of the secondary prizes put together. But patrons will get some free tickets as well. So however much you're pledging, you'll get that many tickets. And yeah, we'll work it like that and see how this goes. It's going to be cool, I promise. All right, so let's get right into this. Here's part two with David Politis. All right, this is part two of my talk with David Politis. And your new book is on hunters, your new Missing 411 book. And one of the things you start this book with is a quote from H.P. Lovecraft. Actually, probably my favorite quote from H.P. Lovecraft. And it goes like this. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but someday in piecing together of disassociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. So why did you pick that?
Yes, you know, someone gave that to me maybe a couple of years ago, and it's actually on the wall in the office here. And I think it just tells you that you should keep an open mind. And there's a lot more to the world that we don't understand. And even if you just watch Ancient Aliens or you watch the Science Channel and how electrons respond when people are watching versus when they're not watching them. And there's so many things we've learned just in the last 10 years that if we continue to keep a closed mind, we're not going to learn more and science isn't going to advance. And I think that to walk around and say we know it all and this is all just normal and, you know, don't worry about it, I really think that's a fool's mentality.
And I would agree. And I think, too, looking at the cases that you cover, there is a little bit of that cosmic – I mean, Lovecraft was famous for creating cosmic horror. And these cases have a touch of that. I mean, there's something that, you know, you look at them and you just say, I don't understand what I'm looking at.
True. Now, live that every day for 6 years and what that would do to your mentality.
Yes. Well, I actually think about these cases a lot. Like anytime I come up with, you know, come across something new, I mean, one of the first things that pop into my mind are these missing people's cases because they are so, I don't know, they're so bizarre. And it seems like we're just missing something. And so every time I come up with some new idea, come across some new idea, I go, could it apply to this?
Well, I said this on Coast to Coast a few weeks ago, is every day, I get an email from somebody who's listened to a couple of your shows, a couple of Coast to Coast shows, and says, hey, I don't mean to be offensive, but I think I know what's going on here. And Sarah, this is the God's truth. I have never gotten an email from anybody who has read the 6 books, understands the entire circumstances that I've laid out, and says, I know what caused this. I've never had one from anyone who's read them all. It's always the people who only listen to a few interviews that think they know. But the circumstances, just like you explained, are so befuddling that when you look at the facts, there isn't an easy answer to them.
No, no, not even slightly. And you can easily look at one case and go, well, maybe this happened. And then you can look at the next case and go, well, maybe this happened. But when you start seeing it over and over, it's clear that these aren't the same thing is happening in these cases, at least 90% of them. So there is no one thing that covers them all. This is where the problem comes in. Individually, they're weird, but they don't stand out like they do when you put them all together.
Correct.
One of the weird things I noticed, and it happened, I think, more in the beginning of the book than later on, but the date September 11th kept popping up.
Yeah, there's a few anomalies that will come up to you that seem odd, but I really don't know if there is any date significance. I mean, if you look at this book, there's an overload in October, November, December, but that's hunting season, so that's when
right.
hunters are going to be out there. But I don't know. I won't say no, but and again, hunting seasons, a lot of seasons start around the same date too, so that's when the most people would be out in the forest.
Sure.
So that could be another reason. I really don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know if there was any significance to it. It just kept standing out to me for some reason. I'm going, oh, look, September 11th again.
Yeah, and I do think that in some jurisdictions, that's a common date that the season starts.
Mm. That would make sense.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a look at some of these, some of the slightly more unusual cases in the book. A lot of them, I mean, they're all unusual in their own right. But you have a few of them here that really kind of stood out to me as something weird. And the first one we can look at is Robert Springfield.
Well, Robert was a Native American, and he was hunting on the Crow Indian Reservation, kind of located in the southeast section of Montana, Bighorn Mountains. This incident happened in September 19th, 2004. He's 49 years old. And this area is known for big game, big mountains. Well, he was with his son, Colton, age 13, and his adopted son, Brent. And they went into an area called Black Canyon for elk hunting. And Robert was a bow hunter, and he was armed. And he couldn't move real good because he had a disability from work. So he was going to stand in one area of the canyon as the kids kind of herded the elk down towards him. Well, as this was going on, and they got later in the afternoon, the kids started to arrive back at a prearranged spot, and Robert didn't come back. And again, this is an area of the reservation where you have to have special privileges to go into, and the public obviously would never go in there. But when he disappeared, the tribal police took over along with the Bighorn County Sheriff. And right away, they got a helicopter with FLIR making low-flying reconnaissance missions over the area, saw nothing. And the SAR search and rescue went on for days, and then his family and friends took it over for more days. Nobody ever found anything. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the sheriff also brought in canines and equestrians, found nothing. In October 2005, about 13 months after the incident happened, the disappearance, a hunter was in that Black Canyon area, and say 150 feet away, he hears a crow screeching its head off, just like bellowing. And it was incessant. And so the hunter started to walk towards the tree where this bird was at, and it never stopped, just screaming and yelling. And he walked to the bottom of the tree, and he saw human remains. Well, the hunter led authorities to the tree where they found a partial skull, a femur, and a neatly rolled up men's belt next to the skull. Two boots sat neatly stacked right next to the skull and the femur, and there was a man's coat on the ground with a small tear in the back, and a wallet was found with money in it, indicating it was Robert's. the only items missing from the scene were his bow and arrows. Well, the sheriff, in his infinite wisdom, decided this is very suspicious, and he called the FBI out to work the scene. So, because this is federal land, because it's an Indian reservation, the FBI has primary authority. Well, they came and they worked it, and they sent the remains to the ID section at Quantico, Virginia. Well, his wife, in the months following, was giving conflicting information as to the cause of death. She was first told he was shot. Then she was later told he was killed by a falling tree. Well, the scene where he was found was just above where this master search and rescue operations center was at. It was close to it. And so there's no way she didn't believe that the body parts were there during the search, because she believed they would have found them. And it says this in all the reports. Now, 2 years after the FBI took custody of the body parts, they still had them, which is weird. And they stated that they were categorizing him in DNA for input into their system. Well, finally, on March 3rd, 2009, almost 5 years after, or 4 years after they found his body, the family had to file a federal lawsuit to get the body parts back. And the lawsuit stated that Robert died under suspicious circumstances and the FBI failed to investigate the incident. Now, they eventually did get the body parts back, but the oddities behind this, you got to think about this clearly. The screeching crow is almost like a beacon. Hey, come here. There's something here.
Yeah.
If someone came across the body and the remains and stole the bow, why not steal the money in the wallet?
Yeah.
And then why would the FBI keep the remains for 2 years and force the family to go to litigation to get it back? To me, that's unbelievable. And then
it seems like more trouble than it would have been worth for them.
Yeah. Or what was there that there must have been something big that they were still looking for in those remains that they couldn't figure out, and they were willing to go to litigation to just give them the time to figure it out.
And it was just a couple of bones, wasn't it?
And a partial skull. But I think the big thing is that when they say he was shot versus a tree fell on him, there's a big difference there.
Right. Right, and no real evidence to back up either one.
No. And then who rolled up the belt, and why would you ever roll up a belt?
Yeah. This is not the first case you've had where the belt has been rolled up.
Well, this is the first case kind of like this where an FBI evidence response team came in, took control of the situation, and then kind of took off with everything. This happened on a case in Klamath Lakes, National Park, and a guy named Charles McCullough, where a ranger, some people found a body 12 miles into the wilderness. Well, McCullough disappeared in the middle of winter right at the side of the lake, and they didn't find him for a couple years. People 12 miles in find this scene with a skull and these little chips of bone, and I actually got to interview the ranger that found the scene. And he said, "Dave, strangest scene I've ever seen in my life." And I knew, my partner and I looked at it and said, "Something isn't right here." And they backed their way out. They called for an FBI evidence response team from Portland, and they came down to Crater Lake, and they worked that scene. And that tells you how suspicious some of these really are. And the suspicious thing to Mary and the ranger, he goes, "Dave, we talked about it for years. How did this 19-year-old kid in the middle of winter, when there's 12 to 20-foot snowdrifts everywhere, how did he get from Lakeside 12 miles into the wilderness to where we eventually found his body?" I go, "What do you think, Mary?" And he goes, "There is no good explanation for that. He didn't have cross-country skis. He didn't have snowshoes. We don't know."
Hmm. The crow definitely stands out in this story as well.
Now, how odd is that?
Yeah. For some reason, it's not as surprising realizing he's Native American.
Right.
But you know, it almost seems like something you'd get in a fictional movie that involved a Native American dying and a crow signaling someone to his body.
Yeah, you're right. It would be a good movie plot line.
But yeah, the belt rolled up implies that someone else was there at some point.
Yeah, and I rolled that around in my mind that maybe another hunter had seen the location, and maybe he was poaching, so he couldn't really admit he was there, and he just got fascinated with it. But again, it goes back to, even if another human did it, why wouldn't they take the money?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm not saying that makes sense. I'm just saying that, you know, the belt rolled up is an intentional act. It's not like the belt fell off his corpse and rolled itself up.
Oh, exactly.
And the fact that the boots were laying right next to the skull as well, it's almost like a prepared scene.
Yep. And that's the way it read in the reports when you get into the minutiae.
And again, I'm sure, you know, especially from the way I just phrased that, people might be thinking, well, it's some kind of satanic cult.
Yeah.
But that's a long time period and a lot of satanic cults killing all these people in these weird ways and only on rare occasions leaving things in a specific pattern.
No, in these reports, none of the investigators even made mention of anything satanic related to it.
It's just one of those go-tos for some people.
Oh, yeah.
Same with cattle mutilation. You see the same thing. Oh, well, it's a satanic cult, despite the fact there's never been evidence of that in all the years that people have been researching cattle mutilations.
That's right.
Now, his bow and such were missing. That's the only thing that was gone, right?
That's right.
What do you find different in the cases about bow hunters versus gun hunters?
You know, to me, it seems as though bow hunters are rarely found.
Hmm.
And, you know, to be a good bow hunter, you have to be stealthy. You have to kind of blend into the wilderness. So I'm not sure what to make of that, but I know that most bow hunters also carry a firearm, a pistol with them. And I know in a lot of the cases I've written about, the bow hunters did have a pistol with them. And there's a case out of New Mexico where a guy named Mel Nadell disappeared. And he had a disability, had a bad knee, carried a 44 Magnum pistol when he went out bow hunting. Told his friends he was just going to go 100 yards down the trail to bow hunt, no further. Disappeared. This was years ago, I mean, five or six, maybe even more. And they never found anything of his. That doesn't make sense.
You do have a case that we're not going to talk about in the book at the very end involving a bow hunter. That's very strange. But people can pick up the book and check that one out.
Yeah, that's the first time I've ever written that kind of story, and it's gotten a lot of interest. But the sources were just impeccably credible, so that's the reason it's in there.
Yeah, and it's not a missing persons case.
Nope, something a hunter saw that is baffling.
Yes. Do you find any, and I guess with hunters, they're generally wearing the same type of thing, but in the collection of all these cases, do you see anything like bright colors sticking out more when people disappear, or camouflaged people disappearing more?
You know, at the beginning, it seemed as though people disappeared wearing bright colors. And, you know, there's a lot of camo clothing out there right now that is orange and black.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, of course, the greens and the grays. And in most of these reports, it doesn't say exactly what the hunter was wearing when they disappeared, surprisingly. Mm.
I know there is a legend, and I believe it's from Malaysia, and I don't know if you covered it or not.
I did.
Okay, where they told them not to wear bright colors into the woods?
Yep, and I even talked about the part in Malaysia where it's happening, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know if it's connected to what's happening here.
Well, people were disappearing in the woods.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing, people almost never, there might be like one or two cases in your books where a couple of people have disappeared at once. It's almost always when someone is alone.
And it's strange because it seems as though a lot of people have said, it seems as though that they're almost stalked and they wait for the point of something to happen. Now, to me, when I was reading about the hunters and I was starting to prepare the book, there were a lot of cases where one hunter would tell another, I don't feel good, I'm going to go back. And it was at that point of separation that the other one disappeared.
Yeah.
And I've stated before in other books that there's a lot of times where people say they're not feeling good before they disappear. And is that some kind of targeted response? Is that some way to separate us? I don't know.
Well, let's look at James McCormick.
That's a tough one. And when I wrote about this case, I had a couple tears in my eyes, I got to say, because I felt real compassion for the dad. Happened 12/5 of 1961, Larch Mountain, Multnomah Falls in Oregon, right on the Columbia River. Absolutely beautiful falls. James McCormick was 16 years old. He was with his dad, also named James. The falls are about 30 miles east of downtown Portland, right on the Columbia River. Absolutely, you could look at them online. They're gorgeous. Well, James and his son were going hunting, and they were going to go for bobcat up on top of Larch Mountain on the backside of the falls. Well, James Sr. was a firefighter for the city of Portland, and he was in good shape. Very experienced hunter. The first day they went hunting, the weather almost immediately turned bad. It first got cold, and then it started to rain, which was soon followed by snow. Well, they took their dog with them, and the three of them were temporarily lost and spent the night on the mountain, kind of huddling together to keep warm. As morning came about, James Sr. ended up carrying his 215-pound son for 3 hours, until he was exhausted and had to put him down. So the boy wasn't feeling well, was cold, and he put him down and he told his son, hey, stay right here. I saw some headlights up here in the woods. I'm going to go see what it is, and I'll come right back. Now, all you have to do is look at a map on the backside of Multnomah Falls. There is nothing back there for miles and miles. Well, his dad left. He came back just a few minutes later, and the boy was gone. He first searched for an hour, and he couldn't find his son, and he immediately headed to the bottom of the mountain and eventually stumbled into the Falls Lodge and requested assistance. Within hours, 200 off-duty Portland firefighters responded, along with a search and rescue team. The sheriff responded with planes, canines, and a search and rescue mountain team. Well, the searchers went back into the area where the dad took him, and they immediately found the boy's boots and socks. Now, stop right there. This makes no sense. Yet it's something that we've talked about earlier, that in these cases, the boots and the socks are found many times. And the boy's glasses were found somewhat near where the dad last saw him. So now you've got a kid who really can't walk far and a kid who can't see. Well, later in the day, the search teams found the boy 300 yards down from where he was last seen at the bottom of a small cliff, dead. Some of the articles implied that the boy died from a fall, and others stated he died from exposure, and there was never a definitive statement. Now, in past books, I've explained of many instances where people disappear with a canine, as these two were. Loss of clothing, loss of boots. The boy doesn't feel well just prior to the disappearance. There's separation between the two people. He becomes vulnerable. Important point here. About 6 months ago, I was watching a segment of Northwoods Law. And it's a show about Maine's Warden Service. And this story was about an older man that was doing maintenance on the Appalachian Trail in Maine. And he didn't come home. And so three wardens went out with a film crew on the trail, and it was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And they're stopped on the trail, and they're looking up the trail, and they see a light in the trees. It's kind of moving around. And they even said on the show, wow, that's kind of unusual, but maybe that's the flashlight of the guy. Now, they don't call out to the guy, which you would think they'd do, because it looks on screen, maybe it's 150 feet away. They walk up that trail, and there's nothing there. The light disappears, and the man was found the next day. Apparently, he got home at 11 o'clock that night. He came off the mountain. He was fine. But to me, when I saw that show, I said, oh, my God, maybe that is what James McCormick Sr. saw when he was on March Mountain.
Well, I mean, the whole will-o-wisp legend of lights leading people astray and stuff fits right in there perfectly.
Yeah.
And again, ties into stories of little people, too. I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that little people are actually taking or hurting these people. I just think that legend has arisen from the same source of whatever is happening here, and that's why we see connections.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't tell you the number of emails I've had from people that have said that they've seen strange lights in the woods. I mean, it's just hundreds of emails like that.
And for him, again, why would he take off his boots?
I mean, if the kid was so tired that he couldn't walk, why would you take off your boots?
And then walk.
Yeah.
Maybe he was completely delirious. Or like the kid we talked about before, maybe he was being affected by something that was disorienting him to such a degree that he didn't know what he was doing.
Well, again, and people, some real acute people that are thinking way ahead of the game, I'm thinking along this way all the time, is I was looking in these reports for any mention of the bottom of James McCormick Jr.'s feet.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's found and his feet are completely clean, well, he didn't walk anywhere.
Now, what is the most number of people you've ever seen taken at one point?
It really wasn't at one point, but there's a case I write about in the books where there were four hunters in northern Colorado, kind of north of Steamboat Springs in the Route Canyon area. And I think two disappeared, one came back. Two go out, one comes back, one goes out and never comes back, and that leaves one. And he went to go get help, and nobody was ever found.
Yeah. So it's kind of like they disappeared individually, though.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't one mass disappearance.
Because it seems like, if I'm remembering right in all these books, I think like two is probably the highest number of people disappearing in groups.
I think you're right.
And but 99% of them is one person, singled out in some way.
And many times, they're found under circumstances where if you didn't know the bigger picture, you could easily kind of just analyze it away as an accident or unfortunate circumstance. But if you look at it, again, from 30,000 feet, and you notice everything that's happening around them, or you notice all the associated factors, you go, wow, yeah, there's more here.
What I keep looking at, and it doesn't explain it, is that part of it could be something environmental. And what I mean by that is you have certain rock types, you have water in the area. There could be something cosmic hitting the area at that point, whether it be electromagnetic field or burst from somewhere in the cosmos, that is setting something off that affects only certain people. But that doesn't explain all the variables. It might also explain why bad weather follows it. If something like that happened, some kind of electrical activity could stir up the weather, create the bad weather. But that doesn't explain how someone's belt gets rolled up and put next to a skull.
Correct.
You know, and it doesn't explain how people get singled out. If that were the sole thing happening, it seems like you would see someone suddenly get dazed, confused, wander off. These people don't disappear within sight of other people.
No, and that's part of the sort of the conundrum of it all.
Have you ever heard of a case where somebody saw someone acting weird right before they disappeared?
Well, other than not feeling well.
Right.
That's probably the most common one.
And there's no, like, specific not feeling well. It's just kind of a, I don't feel that good type of thing, right?
Right.
You talk a little bit about the Great Lakes Triangle, and there's a lot of disappearances around the Great Lakes.
You know, In fact, I've told people to read a book called The Great Lakes Triangle. It's fantastic. It's old. I think it's in the late 60s, early 70s it was written, but there's still copies out there, and you can get them real cheap. And they talk about airplanes, boats, ships, people that have all disappeared and never been found out there. And I read that book probably at about the time I was working cases in that Great Lakes area. And the interesting thing to me is that a lot of those disappearances happened suddenly. People were never found, ships never found, planes never found. In fact, there's some military planes that went into that area over suspicious circumstances and never came out. So there's a lot going on in the Great Lakes. And when you look at the cluster map, I have clusters of disappearances all the way surrounding the Great Lakes. And when we talk about water proximity, that's one of the best cases ever.
Now, a debunker to all this might say that, well, sure, people can drown easier in the water and disappear easier into the water, and that might explain some of these things.
Absolutely could. The unusual part of that, though, is that many of the disappearances in that area around there weren't close to the water, meaning they were 10, 15 miles away. There's two clusters of hunters that disappeared, and the clusters are almost right next to each other. And in one instance, I think there were three or four hunters that disappeared on the same day and were never found. So I think on the face, it goes back to people that just listen to a few videos and don't read the facts and come to these rapid associations and say, oh, you know, think of something easy to explain it away. But in reality, when you look at the facts, they're not so easily explained away.
No, there's always that missing piece.
Correct.
There's always that piece like, it could be this, except for this little part here.
Yeah.
And animal attacks, I mean, that's one people bring up all the time. But animal attacks are fairly obvious. You had a case in here somewhere where it looked like there was a struggle. The snow was all beaten down. It was an older case. But the guy was laying there dead with absolutely no damage to him.
Well, I always bring up a fact that people always want to ignore, and they go, well, it was probably a mountain lion. Well, does anybody know in the last 110 years how many fatal mountain lion attacks there have been in North America?
No idea.
16. And you could go into Wikipedia and look for yourself, but I think that's the number 16 or 17, or 15, I'm not even sure, but the number's so extremely low, it's ridiculous.
And what about bears? Bears aren't generally prone to attack people, correct?
Well, black bears don't normally attack people, no. And that's where, you know, that's 95% of the area in the U.S. There's only a very small area where there's grizzly bears up in Idaho, Montana, and maybe just a sliver of Wyoming, but that's about it. So you can't blame bears for this because, again, if a bear attacks you, what are you going to do? You're going to fight for your life. And normally black bears don't kill people, and you're going to scream, you're going to help. People are going to hear this. There's going to be a scene there. There's going to be blood. There's going to be hair. When trackers come in, they're going to see this. And bears don't consume the whole body. So you're going to find the body.
And because these guys are hunters too, it's far less likely that an animal is going to get the drop on them, and they have a weapon.
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, there's a couple cases I write about in the books where the sheriff made some association when they found the hunter, and his gun was broken in half, and he thought that the sheriff thought that it was some mighty fight with a bear. And I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I don't know.
Yeah, that was a weird one, because there was blood, and it looked like there was some kind of fight. But, I mean, to break a gun apart, as you put it, I mean, it, again, didn't quite make sense.
No.
So let's talk about Rhonda Cardinal.
Well, Rhonda's case has shed some light on this topic that may be important. And happened July 31st, 2012, in a place called Calling Lake, Alberta, Canada. It's about 100 miles north of Edmonton. And she was 42 years old. She was at a hunting cabin. And she was staying there for a week, 10 days. And a relative went up there, found she was gone, and reported her missing. Well, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police searched for her for 8 days with helicopters, ground searchers, ATVs. They flew it every day. And this was a rough area, swampy, thick. And they were befuddled. They didn't know what to think. But they terminated the effort when they found no evidence at all where she might be. And the biggest thing is they couldn't explain why she would have left the cabin in the first place without notifying somebody or explaining what happened or calling a friend or whatever. But her explanation, when they eventually found her, she stated that when she was in the cabin, she must have blacked out. And she woke up in the woods, lost and wandering in the bush. She states that after a few days, she ditched her shoes and took off her T-shirt and wrapped them over her feet. Then she says she ate berries and drank water to survive. She eventually broke into another isolated hunting cabin and found food to survive. She was found on a road by someone driving by who stopped to assist her. And the RCMP estimated that she had to have traveled over 22 kilometers from point to point. Now, the reason I put this in here is that what caused her to black out?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a statement of blacking out, and there's another statement of missing time. And I'm not sure what Rhonda really meant. And if there's a loss of memory, well, she can't account for that time then. So is it just semantics that we're talking about?
Right.
And where had she gone during that time, and what had she done?
And why take the shoes off and wrap her feet with her shirt?
Yeah, it's contrary to logic.
I mean, unless the shoes were really hurting her for some reason.
Another person who already read that said, well, maybe she just said that, but maybe there's something else there that she just doesn't want to admit to. I have no
idea. Maybe.
You know, maybe she has some slight memory of something else that she doesn't want to address.
Or maybe she doesn't even fully remember. She's just guessing that that's what she did.
Exactly. I think that's probably pretty logical.
I mean, it's one of the few cases where someone is found alive, but it doesn't give us answers. It gives us more puzzle pieces, if anything.
And I don't know. I think that's an intriguing one just because she's found alive and she's willing to say that, yeah, I don't have any memory of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you state throughout the books, a lot of the people who are found alive, the ones who are able to communicate that aren't, you know, too young or have too many mental issues, they seem to have a very hazy recollection of what happened to them.
Yep. Sometimes they don't remember anything. They don't remember why they got lost, where they've been, or how they were found.
And to me, that suggests the possibility of an altered state of consciousness, that you're just not remembering when you return to a normal state of consciousness. But what sets that state of consciousness off, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, is it something that specifically targets these people? Or is it something that just happens and allows them into a different state of mind?
Well, you know, I was thinking about when I finished the book. I was sitting in my house by myself, and I was flipping through the channels, and I just happened to hit on one of these hunting shows. And I was watching these guys sitting in the blind day after day, and I'm thinking how many tens of thousands of hunters there must be out there that must have seen something or must have experienced something. But because it's a hunting environment, machoism and things, they never want to discuss it.
True. True. Very true. And there's a lot of weird things that people just don't want to talk about, hunter or not.
Oh.
They don't want to be laughed at.
Oh, yes.
Do you still get people telling you it's Bigfoot?
Again, it's only the people that haven't read the books. and it's those people, oh, I know what you meant. It was Bigfoot. it's insane. I mean, there's some people that make posts and say, oh, I said it was Bigfoot. I've never said that. And, I mean, some people just completely fabricate. I mean, what can I say?
What, you've always been very careful from the time you published the first book on to not really pin anything on it because you can't prove any of it. Do you feel you understand this stuff better, or do you just have more questions as you go on?
You know, sometimes I think the more I know, the less I really know. And then other times I think, well, there's people that are giving us little pieces to the puzzle, and we need to focus on those, like this woman who doesn't have any memory, and she was in a cabin, then she was out. Well, there's other stories I've written about where kids, very small kids, were in a house with their aunt. She falls asleep. There's an alarm on the house. She wakes up. The dog's gone. The kid's gone, but the alarm is still on. How did the kid get out?
Yeah. And you look to Whitley Strieber and his, you know, incursion into his house where they put the implant in his ear and they never set off the alarm.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that's the same thing, but it's just the first thing that comes to mind with an alarm that didn't get set off that should have.
And, you know, it's those kind of facts that people don't want to acknowledge. And when they hear about that, they think, oh, you know what, that's just an anomaly. That didn't, and they shuck it off because it represents too much. You know, how it's obviously not a human that's involved here. If they can defeat the alarm, get inside your house, and take you out without it ever going off.
Or if it is a human, it's someone with technology way beyond what we know about.
Oh, that's for sure.
I mean, we know the government has black projects. I mean, you were talking earlier about potential of weather modification. I mean, we know we have ways of modifying the weather, but if these black projects are a decade, two decades ahead of what we know exists, and our technology's advancing at the speed that it is, we have no idea what might actually be out there.
Well, there's a book called Camellio. Have you heard of it?
I don't think so.
It's only been out about 3 or 4 months. And what it is, it's a story about a young kid kind of thing north of San Diego that is harassed incessantly by a group of people that have stealth technology and actually can become invisible. And he implicates the Department of the Navy. And this guy, real credible guy, wrote a great book about the incident and the technology and how it appeared that they were just testing it on this kid that was using drugs because they probably thought nobody would give a damn and never give the kid an ounce of credibility as to what he claimed. And it's a really intriguing story. Knapp had the guy on his show and he called me later and said, you got to read this book. And I said, all right. And it was a good one. It's a good one.
Can you spell that?
Oh, I figured you'd ask me that. Okay, it's C-H-A-M, like Mary, E-L-E-O, C-H-A-M-E-L-E-O. The guy's name is Robert Guffey, G-U-F-F-E-Y.
Huh. And I've heard things like that before, that the government is testing out different kinds of mind control on random people. And it's one of those things you can't prove or disprove.
I know one thing. I don't want to be one of their victims.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, we know from history, things like MK Ultra and other projects, that they're not above doing something like this.
It's a scary thing. I don't even want to think about it. I mean, you got to hope that it's our government. We're using it for good things and not testing it on our own people, except our government has proven that they will test it on us.
Yes. Yeah. The other thing about the Rhonda Cardinal case is it does bear some resemblance to the mysterious non-drownings of your last book.
It's true.
It's that blacking out. You had a few cases, if I remember, where people blacked out and didn't know where they were or what they were doing.
That's true.
Now, you, in covering those cases, I know recently there's been a bunch of articles about a particular drug that people are using on the street to kidnap people.
Well, I've talked about it in Missing 411, a sobering coincidence that some really, really advanced medical examiners did some things that weren't normally done, and they tested for GHB, and they found it in some of these dead boys that were found in the water. And how it got into them, nobody knows. Why it was given to them, well, it kind of makes you're awake, you know what's happening, but you really can't move much. And, you know, if you were given that and then dropped in the water, you would die of a drowning. It'd be a horrific death. And in the end, if they hadn't tested for the GHB, it would be just listed as a common drowning. And this is what I write about in the books, and nobody wants to talk about this. Nobody wants to address it. And the unusual nature of these disappearances, it's beyond weird.
There was a listener who had sent me something very interesting, and he said, just a quick observation I've made in regards to the presence of GHB being found in these individuals. Looking on the wiki page for GHB, it states GHB has neuroprotective properties and is found to protect cells from hypoxia, and that generalized hypoxia occurs in healthy people when they ascend to high altitude, where it causes altitude sickness, leading to potentially fatal complications. High altitude pulmonary edema and high altitude cerebral edema are the two main complications. Now, in the last book, you talk a couple of times where it almost seems like someone's just snatched up.
Yep.
And in these cases, the fact that these people just suddenly disappear.
Correct.
It's really unfortunate no one has ever tested one of these found wilderness disappearances for GHB. I mean, they wouldn't think to. I mean, why would they?
Well, you know, when they go through a common autopsy, there's a screen they do for, you know, coke, crank, meth, all this stuff. But GHB is one of them that they don't test for. And I know that there's a couple medical examiners that I talk to regularly, and they're probably going to write a white paper about these deaths and the need to open up the screening to GHB. And once I think that you educate the masses and they need to know that, hey, this is something that's becoming more common and we need to screen for it, I think it'll probably happen. But, you know, it's like everything. It's nickels and dimes. And can they afford to spend another 10 or 15 bucks per body on a GHB screen? I don't know.
But it is interesting. If it does do that, if someone ascends to a height quickly and it has GHB into it, you know, and it can create GHB in a system. Okay, I see what he's saying. I was thinking that the body creates it, but he's saying that it protects the person.
Well, actually, our body does produce GHB in very low volumes. Not
really?
Enough to hurt us. Right. And I write about that in the book, and I explain it.
Okay, I didn't remember that part.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting connection, because I do remember you talking about the possibility of people being snatched upwards suddenly. Also, it struck me at one point that if someone is encountering some kind of portal, I mean, not that we know whether or not portals exist or not, but any kind of, like, change could create hypothermia-like effects on the person. that maybe the weather is not causing that to happen, but their sudden removal of clothes could be from a sudden temperature change caused by something else.
Well, I think it was Missing 411 North America and Beyond. I wrote about that in a handful of cases, the kids, when they were found, were immediately taken to a hospital. And on a whole series of those, doctors indicated that the kids had a low-grade fever. And the vast majority of times, the victim is either deceased or they can't get to medical care quickly. But in those instances, they did. And I wrote in there that it seemed to be unusual that it was just a low-grade temperature and the doctors didn't align it with any medical issue.
Yeah, I remember that. The other note I had made here, we talk about people being found where they were previously searched. This is something you see also in poltergeist cases where objects will disappear and someone will be looking all over the house for them and they'll come back and they'll be right where they're supposed to be.
Right.
How that would connect in, I don't know, but it was in talking to people about poltergeist cases that just stuck out to me that, you know, oh, they found it where they had previously searched for it. And it's like, right, where does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
And wherever these things are going, and that's the other thing, stuff that's apported in poltergeist cases is often warm. Like if rocks suddenly form and start falling in someone's house or something, they're usually hot to the touch.
Huh.
So if something like this happens to a person, they may suddenly get very, very hot.
Yeah.
Whether that's has anything to do with what's actually going on, it's just, you know, little pieces my brain put together that may or may not have any basis in reality.
Huh. That's good.
I mean, we know what's happening in the poltergeist cases to an extent. We know they're being created by people unconsciously. Like I said, it doesn't explain the missing 411 stuff because I doubt people are unconsciously causing themselves to go missing.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
But whatever mechanism creates that can move things around in poltergeist cases could potentially be responsible for some of these missing people.
Yeah. Interesting.
But in the end, we don't have an answer.
No, we don't.
And I know there are people out there who think you know what's going on and you just don't want to tell us.
It's hilarious. I mean, if it was so easy and all the information's out there, somebody tell us.
So the book is available now. The only place people can get it, well, it's not the only place. The only place they should get it is the canammissing.com site.
Yeah, if they only want to pay retail, so as long as they don't want to spend, you know, $75 to $125.
Yeah, so avoid Amazon for this book.
Amazon, eBay, any of those sites. Don't go to them.
You do have it available in a box set with all how many books?
6 books.
Okay. The map is available as well if someone wants to get an outlay. How many cases are actually on the map? Roughly?
I would say at least 1,500.
Wow. And that's only the ones you found.
Right.
And the documentary will be out eventually.
End of this year, early next year. It's done. It's at the film festivals right now.
Okay. And you have a YouTube, too, that's linked off of the Can-Am Missing, right?
Yep. You can go to the Can-Am Missing website. canammissing.com, and you can find all kinds of links that give you more information. There's a current events page that has right up to date with cases that we're looking at that are unusual.
Okay. Anything sticking out to you at the moment?
There's been a giant surge in missing cases in the last 3 weeks. I think probably there's 10 or 12 of them right now.
Really? In one area or across the U.S.?
All over.
And if people have a case, do you want them sending them to you?
Well, only if it matches the profile of what we're looking for. And if it matches that, for sure, send them to it at missing411@yahoo.com.
So you don't – and that's something I think people need to understand. There is a criteria you're looking for. It's not just missing people. It's not just strange disappearances. It's it's the stuff we've talked about over the last 2 hours. It's very specific points.
That's it. Yes, sir.
And I feel like since I've been talking to you about this stuff over the last few years, if I see a missing persons case, when those points are there, they stick out like a sore thumb. They really do.
Yeah, I've got 4,700 friends on Facebook, and they're always sending me things that a lot of times I've never heard of, but are right on the money. Yeah, you're right.
How many new cases do you end up seeing every week?
Well, people probably throw at least 5 cases at me every week, and out of those 5, I'd say maybe 1 out of every 2 weeks, one of them is valid.
Do you update anywhere if any of these cases do get solved?
Oh, yeah. And some of the cases in this book, I updated them from previous books.
Okay. But, like, have any of the cases had more mundane explanations? People have been found and they say, oh, well, we know exactly what happened to them now.
Not really, no.
Okay. All right. Any appearances or anything coming up? People, where you're going to be speaking or anything?
I'm going to be at the Philadelphia MUFON conference later this year. So if you just go Google MUFON Philadelphia conference, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in Chicago at a Spook Fest. They're going to have me speak there. I'm going to be in Albuquerque in a couple weeks, and then I'm going to be in Phoenix, Arizona at the Phoenix MUFON in third week of September.
Nice. All right. And again, everything related to this can be found at canammissing.com.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you so much, David.
Hey, Soraya, it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate the time.
All right, and that concludes part 2. Please go to wheredidtheroadgo.com for all your last exit needs. You can find all our various social media there. And I want to thank everyone for their support. We'll be back next week. And I'm going to take you out with a band, a local band here called Sanjero Fields. And this is a track called This Ship I Call a Skull. See you next week.
To you, one bloody moment changes everything.